The Gospel of Mark chapter 13, where we left off in Jesus' farewell address, what I like to call it. It's technically known as the Olivet Discourse because he went over from the temple. The last time he went on the Mount of Olives, looking at the Temple Mount, and essentially gave to his disciples a little insight into the future, what would take place. And that farewell address, we noted, was similar to what Jacob gave to his sons in Genesis 49 and what Moses gave to the people in Deuteronomy 32 and 33. And what he also gave, what Samuel gave to his people and what Paul gave to the elders in Acts 20. Prediction. The idea of the Lord, you see, he's outside of time. So part of his signature, that what he's saying is from him, the Bible, which actually stands head and shoulders above any other religious book on the area because God has signed it. He's let us know the things that will happen before they happen so that you wouldn't guess, gee, I think that's a religious book, or gee, I think maybe that's from God, that you would know. And this is the feature that the critics of the Bible just kind of ignore. They could talk about the supposed contradictions and, oh, you don't believe the Bible, it's so out of date, so many translations, how do we really know what we have? You hear that, but they never talk about the amazing predictions, the signature that God gave, that you would know this is Him. So we have a little bit of that here. And the first part we looked at were the birth pangs. Jesus called them the beginning of sorrows. These things would happen, wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines and pestilences. That we talk, look, those things have always been, but toward the end you would see an increase similar to like a woman in labor. And we see that. And then, of course, we noted how Jesus got practical with his disciples, that when persecution would come, how they need to take the opportunity. That's an opportunity for the testimony to go forth. And I think anytime we go through trials and pains and difficulties, if we could just look through them to see, wait a minute, there's something deeper here. There's something even more profound. I wouldn't waste those sorrows and I wouldn't waste it and miss that opportunity to see how God could turn something as tragic as death into life. Something as tragic as what happened to Haiti into opportunities for the gospel. And something even that happens in whether it's China or Iran or Korea, North Korea, some of the places that are most hostile to the gospel, turns that into opportunities for the church to grow and thrive and the power of his testimony. And so our part, go and tell the world. His part, he'll come back. And Jesus then now brings the judgment on Jerusalem into a bigger picture of the coming judgment to the world. So in verse 14, where we left off, through the end of the chapter, we're going to look at that and really look at Watch and Be Ready, part 2. The sign of the abomination of desolation, the great tribulation, the sign of the coming of the Lord, and then our response practically now to these teachings. Let's pick up in verse 14. And we get hit with the most complex one right away. Verse 14, Jesus says to his disciples, remember, they're overlooking the Temple Mount. He's just talked about the destruction of Jerusalem and the birth pangs. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing where it ought not, let the reader understand. What is he saying? Well, by saying let the reader understand, Mark is assuming the reader is going to know about these things. Oh yeah, you know what that is. It's about what Daniel wrote of. In Jesus' day, they were very familiar with Daniel's prophecies. In fact, there was a messianic expectation. They knew he had to be close because of Daniel 9 and the prediction of looking for the Messiah to come. But then there's this weird statement in Daniel 9:27 about this man would confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, that is a 7-year period. In the middle of that 7-year period, he'd bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And then on the wing of desolations shall be one who makes desolate, even to the consummation which is determined. And so it's a very weird statement. Daniel 11 describes it in verse 31 as the abomination of desolation. When the sacrifices in the temple cease, and they're replaced by what is called the abomination of desolation. Okay, so what is that? Well, the abomination, the word abomination, is literally, it's a filthy idol. The most detestable thing to God. Why is that? Because an idol is a replacement. Instead of God in the center of your heart, instead of Him on the throne, instead of Him being your God, your Creator, your Redeemer, you put something else there, an idol. In this case, it's an abomination of greater proportions, of desolation. That is, it will bring this particular idol. There are many idols sometimes you have in your heart, and they cause you more pain than you realize. Because as soon as you put something else in that place where only God should have, it's eventually going to tear away at you. It's going to consume you. And you're going to become like the God you serve. The inanimate objects that you hold dear, or some pleasures that you hold dear, you're going to become consumed by them. God alone can fill that heart that He has made. And so we all have those many idols we need to put aside, but the great one, the great abomination of a desolation will be, and the devastation means that which will lead to the devastating judgment of God. So Jesus is saying, that you've heard about what Daniel said, let the reader understand this, Mark says, about the abomination of desolation, standing where it ought not. He's making a reference to the temple. Something in the temple is going to take the place of that which God put there in order to meet with you. That is, that's what really the temple was all about. It was a temporary structure in which, in that holiest of holies, the Ark of the Covenant was there, that the blood of the bull that would be sprinkled on that Ark of the Covenant, atoning for the sins of the whole nation, so that God then could have fellowship with His people. It was temporary, though. It wasn't meant to be permanent. Jesus is the true temple. His blood on the cross takes away your sin once and for all. No more need for a temple. No more need for the sacrifices. But Jesus is predicting something here that's relating to the temple. Those who see this prediction as referring to, there was a prefigured type of this. They were all familiar with the Seleucid dynasty and the notable leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, who was really nicknamed Antiochus the Madman, who hated the Jewish people. He conquered Jerusalem. He came in, he attempted to Hellenize them, that is, make them like the Greeks. And he forbade them to offer sacrifices. He actually forced them to offer a pig on the altar. And then he put a statue of Zeus in place on the burnt offering, the altar, possibly an image of himself. Well, that was the start of the whole revolt that led to them cleansing the temple. And that, of course, we know, and Jewish people celebrate that today, as Hanukkah. So Jesus mentions this abomination. That was a picture of it. But since that already happened, he's not obviously referring to that. He's referring to something in the future, because that already took place. So, what is he talking about? There was another emperor, Caligula, who was a madman himself, who actually had intended to put a statue of himself in the temple. It was actually made on a boat on the way when he died. So they, we're not going to put it up now. Didn't put it up. The Apostle Paul in 2 Thessalonians 3 describes something. If you'll turn there to chapter 2, you'll kind of see a big picture here. He speaks about this coming before the judgment, and that's exactly what Jesus is saying. You're going to see the abomination of desolation. This will happen before the great judgment comes of the coming of the Lord. But he tells people in chapter 2, verse 3, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed. So the judgment day isn't going to come until the man of sin shows himself, who opposes, verse 4, and exalts himself above all that is called God or all that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple, showing himself to be God, or that he is God. And then Paul reminds them, hey, you remember what I was talking to you, and what you know it's restraining, that it'll be in its own time revealed. The mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who restrains will do so. Something's restraining this personage from coming to this world to be that one who will be the great, person who will stand in the temple. Now listen, This is interesting. Paul refers to something that will happen in a temple. In his day, the temple was still around, but it was destroyed. This is why so many, and there are many godly, good Christians who believe that this abomination happened in the time when the Romans came and destroyed the temple. And then they have a problem, however, because if you believe that happened back then that has to spiritualize the whole tribulation and spiritualize even the coming of the Lord. And really gets kind of dicey, because you have to believe then that the Great Tribulation took place back then and that Jesus came back then and is ruling kind of secretly from heaven. Now, in many ways, he is ruling over his people. He's ruling in our hearts. But that's not the coming of the end that the Lord spoke about. Now, this temple, listen, Paul describes this one who is going to come, and then Daniel tells us that when that daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation comes, there's going to be 1,290 days, Daniel 12:11, if you're taking notes. So it'll be exactly 3.5 years until the coming of the end, which fits that 7-year period right in the middle, which means that that's what's going to happen. This person the Bible refers to as the man of sin, also known as the Antichrist, also known as the beast in Revelation 13, is going to make a covenant with the nation Israel. In the middle of the covenant, he's going to break it, and this is how he breaks it. They've followed him as the Messiah up until the time he does this, when he exalts himself as God. Now, there's a lot more to that than you think. You see, there's something going on there with all of us, because this is Satan, through this man, presenting himself as a man yet to be God. Isn't that interesting? That's the very same lie that Satan gave to Eve. You remember that? If you eat of this fruit, you can be like God. And that was the temptation she took of that fruit and ate. And then Adam transgressed and brought sin into the world by that act of rebellion, by eating of that fruit. Ultimately, the temptation was to be as God. I find that old lie that he gave them has revived itself. Even today, when you talk about the New Age, they don't say New Age anymore. They call it the New Spirituality. But ultimately, what that is, it's an exaltation of self. I mean, Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs pretty much took the world by storm. You cannot get trained in any business or psychology or grief counseling or any of that stuff without getting indoctrinated by Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You've got your physiological needs, then you've got your needs for safety and security, then your social needs, and then your needs of, you know, eventually the peak is self-actualization. That is to say that at the very root of all of you, that what's within you is the most powerful thing to bring it out. We've had many cultural things and environmental inhibitions and factors that have kept us from self-actualizing. But if we could just self-actualize, then that would be the answer. Essentially, be your own God. Now, Satan knows this. Lie is just a beautiful lie. There's a beautiful side to evil. Listen, to be your own God is very tantalizing, and that's kind of what kept me in rebellion. I'm going to do my own thing. I don't need God. And he kept me running after that carrot for a lot of years. Only by the grace of God did the Lord open my eyes to see I'm not God. That only God is God. He created me, and I'm created for his pleasure. You know, when some people hear that, they go, ooh, you know, like that just grates against them because they're still in that deception. And Satan, the Antichrist, will come and deceive people all over the world. And I think he'll use this whole idea of helping you self-actualize, become your old God. But eventually he's going to say, by the way, I was just lying. You're not God. I'm God. And he's going to stand in the temple and everybody's going to realize, oh, this one they worshipped, the whole world worshipped the beast. That was wrong. And at that time, judgment's going to break forth. All this in that abomination of desolation, Jesus reminds them. He tells them how they should respond when that happens. The end of verse 14, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down into the house, nor enter to take anything out of the house. By the way, the housetop feature was true in the ancient days of Israel, but it's also true in modern Israel. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babes in those days. And of course, Matthew adds, woe to those, pray that it's not on the Sabbath, and pray that your flight may not be in winter. You know, every one of these exhortations really has more application to those living in the there in the Jerusalem at the time. It presupposes a temple will be built again. Because there is no temple there now. There's the Dome of the Rock. This presupposes a rebuilt temple. Which is why a lot of people who believe the literal Bible, which I think you should believe literally, I mean, all of the prophecies of the past have been fulfilled literally, so why should we spiritualize this now? That temple will be rebuilt. You know, in fact, there's a temple institute that actually is a group of Jewish people very sincere in believing that they're going to rebuild the temple and reinstitute the animal sacrifices. Now, when Christians hear that, they get excited. Yeah, because that's a fulfillment. But be careful. Don't get too excited. You shouldn't really be thankful that this temple will be rebuilt, because what that means is that they don't believe Jesus' sacrifice was enough. They're going to go back to the old sacrifices. And eventually that will be the temple the Antichrist will deceive them in. But the fact that it is being rebuilt should encourage us in one sense that, well, God's word is true. People who kind of figured that Israel would never become a nation, that would never happen literally, years of commentaries have been spiritualized. And even today, there's a growing number of people who, when you talk about the end times, their eyes gloss over. They say, well, we don't really know. We can't really talk about that stuff. We don't really know how it's going to work out. There's so many opinions. So they go, well, it doesn't matter. I beg to differ with you. The emphasis in the Bible tells you it should matter. There are those who believe that it already happened back in AD 70, so they don't care. And then there are those who believe, no, this is yet to happen. This is prediction. And I believe that that is the right tack to take, because now we can do what Jesus says in regard to this. Now, in this case, this is application to people living in Israel at that time. Some say this was fulfilled, of course, when the Romans came in and destroyed. But I really believe that the near and far fulfillment is true here, because immediately following this comes the Great Tribulation. And you cannot spiritualize verse 19 through verse 27. Notice what he describes. He says, for in those days there will be tribulation, such has not been since the beginning of the creation which God created until this time, nor shall ever be. And unless the Lord had shortened those days, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, whom he chose, he shortened the days. Now, this brings some trouble to some people's minds who are believers, because maybe you felt that, wait a minute, are we going to be there during the tribulation? I thought the rapture was going to take Christians out before this tribulation. But here, the elect are here. Now, keep in mind, I don't believe these elect are the elect of the church. Because it's not until later, Jesus didn't talk about the church. He very few mentions in the New Testament or in the Gospels about the church. Because primarily he was speaking to the nation Israel. But he said, there are many more things I have to share with you. I can't, but when the Holy Spirit comes, he'll lead you and guide you into all truth. Then came the fuller teaching of the mystery of the Gentile people who would come to faith and the church that would grow throughout the world, his people. And then Paul describes how the promises of this church escaping. Luke tells us, you know, pray that you'll be counted worthy to escape out of, not just through, but out of the tribulation. Revelation 3:10, a promise to the church that they could be removed from the tribulation. And then, of course, we have a description in 1 Thessalonians 4 about that rapture, the being caught up with the Lord, and that we're not appointed to wrath, which is what the tribulation is. Now, some will say, wait a minute, why should we think that people have experienced tribulation in the past and that we should think we would escape it? Well, that's not just any old tribulation. That's the Great Tribulation. That the Bible calls is the day of His wrath. That's going to come, the judgment. That's the desolation after the abomination. Every other generation of Christians never had to experience that. Why would this generation? I'll throw the same question back. See, it's serious tribulation. Now, serious tribulation has happened throughout the world since the time of Jesus. I mean, you look at the bubonic plague in Europe, quarter of the world killed in 1343, and in those 4 or 5 year period around there, 170 million people, according to some research, have been killed by some political machinery, something that man has caused in the past couple thousand years. That's staggering. But nothing of this is like the Great Tribulation, described in Revelation, cataclysmic events, which will also be accompanied by, notice, great deception. Notice verse 21. If anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or look, there he is, don't believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. But take heed, see, I have told you all things beforehand. Who are the elect then in this period of time if it's not the church? The Bible tells us in Revelation that there are going to be millions who will come through the tribulation, who will not take the mark of the beast, who will not be deceived, who will resist, and they'll suffer martyrdom as a result of it. And they'll receive great promise and hope, and they will be protected. And listen, the Bible tells us when the Antichrist comes, he is going to come with all power, signs, and lying wonders, according to 2 Thessalonians 2. And he's with unrighteous deception, he's going to deceive people, those who did not receive the love of the truth. You're only in danger of being deceived if you reject the gospel of Jesus Christ. But you know, when the tribulation begins, when this happens, there'll be many people who never had a clear picture. And I believe the Lord will pour out His Spirit upon the Jewish testimony, because many of the Jewish people will realize, wait a minute, something's wrong here. They're not going to be deceived. What the church has grown among Gentiles, I believe in the tribulation, Jewish people will play a prominent role, and they will be witnesses through the whole world, so that out of every tribe, nation, kindred, tongue, there will be people who will believe in Jesus in the tribulation period. But there will be many people deceived. I think the people most likely to be deceived are those who heard the gospel very clearly on this side, who rejected it, and when that time comes, instead of them going, oh yeah, my grandmother used to talk about the mark of the beast, I'm not going to take that. See, that's what people think. I think they'll be most likely deceived. That's just my opinion, but it seems sensible. Here, I'm amazed at this picture. He says, take heed, verse 23, see, I have told you all these things beforehand when this comes to pass. And notice what will also accompany the great cosmic disturbances, verse 24. But in those days, after the tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars of heaven will fall, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. I have a difficulty thinking this all took place in AD 70. Back in the first century, I don't think so. Now, some who very meaning, listen, there's some believers that hold that. And they're godly people, and you know what? They're the Lord's. This is a family debate, remember. We can't get too crazy about this. But they believe that, this is spiritualized poetic language for the social and political turmoils. But don't forget, Jesus already talked about the social and political turmoils already. So why would he then use metaphoric language to describe it? No, in past, there have been environmental, cataclysmic events that took place in the time of the Egyptian exodus, when Israel had the exodus. The long day of Joshua basically undermined the Canaanites' solar worship. Elijah and Elisha's miracles undermined the deception of Baal. And I believe that when the sun and the moon are darkened, the stars don't give their light, that is going to be one of the huge signs. Man is not in control. That there is a God. The stars of heaven will fail and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Not just darkened. Some say these catastrophic events are causing this smoke that generates in the world. It'll block out the light. But no, he's not just saying darkened alone, but also failing. Isaiah describes the heavens shall be dissolved. The earth will be rolled up like a scroll in Isaiah 34. So these are real cataclysmic events that will take place after the tribulation. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. And that He will send His angels and gather together His elect from the four winds and from the farthest part of the earth to the farthest part of heaven. Now again, if you think this goes back to AD 70, after the Romans come in, the destruction comes, and then these things are poetical descriptions of the political turmoil at the time. But now you've got to deal with this. Then the coming of the Lord. When you're a real diehard preterist, that is, you believe all these things happened in the past, you have to believe that that happened in the first century. Jesus, remember when He, you know, before His disciples, and the angels said, just in the same manner He's leaving, He's going to come back. What the predicate has to say is that Jesus did. He came back in the clouds. Where do you find that? In history. And then, of course, He will send His angels and gather together His elect from the four winds. Now, be careful on this one. A lot of Christians get a little confused here because they try to relate this with the rapture. I don't think this fits the rapture. There's a couple of reasons. First of all, in Mark, the Son of Man comes on the clouds, but in 1 Thessalonians 4, in the rapture, believers are coming with the Lord in the clouds. So He's coming to judge the world and to gather His elect, but in 1 Thessalonians, we actually descend with Him. In Mark, the angels gather the elect, while in 1 Thessalonians, the Lord Himself gathers His believers. In 1 Thessalonians, He only speaks of the voice of the archangel, where in the Olivet Discourse, nothing is said about a resurrection. So those are two different events. I don't believe that the rapture and the second coming are the exact same thing. There's too many differences. If you're post-tribulational, you kind of believe that the rapture will occur, we'll meet Jesus in the air, and then come right back to the earth when He comes down and reigns. Which, some hold that view, and godly people on both sides of this. Remember, it's a family debate. But I believe that the elect in Mark 13 are a reference to the Jewish remnant who will come to faith in the Messiah, and all of those who will believe in Him in that period of time, He's going to come and He's going to gather them. And notice, He's going to gather them from the furthest part of heaven as well. All of those who died believing in the coming Messiah, I believe, are going to be gathered. And they're going to go through in the millennial kingdom, that the Lord will reign and we will reign with Him. So I believe these events are speaking of this. Now, what about the timing of this? Jesus already spoke about the birth pangs, you know, these things that would happen increasingly. But now He gives another picture for us, His disciples. Verse 28, He says, "Now learn the parable from the fig tree." If you had a fig tree, this would make a lot more sense. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know the summer is near. That would be true in pretty much anything. You could see the daffodils or the flowers starting to bloom. So summer is near. He says, "So also, when you see these things happening, know it is near at the doors." What things? What He's described. The level and intensity of these cataclysmic events, now culminating in the soon coming of the Lord. Listen, He says, when you see these things happen, though, He says, "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." Now here's where the disconnect comes for many believers, and probably why some have held strongly to the view that this all took place back in the first century. Because they take this verse 30, and they take it alone. And they think it stands by itself. And they think Jesus is telling His disciples, this generation, all of you guys here, you will not die until you see all this happen. If you believe that, then it has to be in the first century. But when you connect it with the verse 29, it makes much more sense. When you see these things happening, know that it is near, that this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Which generation? The generation who sees these things happening. It makes much more sense. Heaven and earth will pass away, but My words will by no means pass away. Remember, the disciples said, when will all these things take place? He says, hey, think of the fig tree. You see the leaves getting tender and coming out, then you know it's near, right at the door. And this generation that sees these things will not pass away. Now, some people have gotten real technical with this fig tree and relating it to the nation Israel to the degree that they have, and then even getting more specific, Israel became a nation in 1948. They went out on a limb. And they basically said, well, a generation is 40 years. So if you count 40 years from 1948, that's 1998. So 1981 would be the rapture. And I remember when 1981 was almost ending, and there were a lot of believers thinking, this is it. You know what? They were playing too fast with this. Then when that didn't happen, then they said, well, wait a minute. Jerusalem wasn't part of it, so when they conquered Jerusalem in 67, now we'll take 40 years from 67, we'll go to the year 2007, minus 7 years for the tribulation. The year 2000 became important. That didn't happen, obviously. Where does the Bible say a generation is 40 years? In fact, when he speaks about the 400 years they were in Egypt, he describes it as four generations. So that's 100 years. But then in other places it's 40, so there's really not a definitive marker. I just think it's a little more plain than that. Because once you start getting into the dates, you're starting to get into this date setting and many people fall into the trap. The point is, look, what is he saying to his disciples? Notice how he follows up with this exhortation. And he says this, but of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. The Son in his humanity couldn't tell the disciples right then. He goes, I don't know. Being emptied of his Godhood in the human form, in perfect submission to the Father, the Father didn't tell him. Only the Father knows. Take heed, he says, watch and pray, for you do not know what time it is. It's like a man going to a far country who left his house and gave authority to his servants to each his work and commanded the doorkeeper to watch. Watch, therefore, you don't know when the master of the house is coming, in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch. So when he speaks about the fig tree, we do have Israel over there. For 2,000 years, they haven't been there. Now they're there. We see this movement to rebuild this temple, which has to be rebuilt. We see the political tensions in the world, the great cataclysmic things. By the way, you know, I didn't bring this point up about the birth pangs. One of the brothers who works for Time Magazine gave me this book that was produced by Time Books called Starting Over. Not a Christian book. It's written by the managing editor of Fortune magazine, Andy Serwer. Now, interesting about this book is the whole point of it is why the last decade, he says, was so rotten and why the next one will surely be better. This is a record of this last decade. And you know what? When I was reading through this, it was like, wow, that was one bleak decade. 2000, the rains, the flooding in Africa left millions homeless. Many died. The price of gasoline soared to more than $2 a gallon, if you remember. Wouldn't that be nice? The presidential election ended in a lot of controversy. 2001, 9/11, and you know Enron filed for Chapter 11. Then 2002, and I'm just taking some of them because there were a lot more of them. You know, you saw all of these disasters, the Chechen terrorists seized the Moscow theater, 120 hostages, and you had WorldCom disclosing fraud, and they went bankrupt. Then 2003, the space shuttle Columbia disintegrated, re-entry, the power failures in the U.S. and Canada. And you know, I mean, he goes on all these things, the earthquake in Iran, the mad cow disease, and the scare that that caused. The U.S. death toll in Iraq is now starting to go past 1,000 then. The undermining of the military with the prisoner abuse in Guantanamo. You know, all of these things took place. Tsunami killed over 200,000 people. Then Ahmadinejad was elected the Iranian president in 2005. And he goes on and on, all the way through the decade. It's just one bad story after another. And then his whole point is, the next decade's going to be better. Because the old point is, it can't get any worse. That's a vain hope that the world has. We know better. As we're watching these signs, we know, look, we're getting close. Now, what do you do when you think you're getting close? What changes in your life as a result of that? You know, I think the whole point of that is that that we're not in the dark as a non-believer. We're in the light. We can see these things. We know what the Scriptures say. We believe them. And we live accordingly. Let me ask you a question. If you were expecting a guest to come to your home for dinner some night and you're, you know, as you're getting close to the time they're coming, what are you doing? You're cleaning, you're cooking, putting the candles out, you're getting the place setting, you're getting ready for your guests to arrive. But if they call and say, oh, you know, so-and-so's sick, we're not coming over, what do you do? You stop preparing, right? Because they're not coming over. You know, in many ways, this is the world of where Christians are or they're not. There are those that are eagerly waiting their master's return. They're like, in this parable described here, like those who are waiting for their master to come. They're watching. They don't know if it's going to be evening, midnight. They're ready. They're ready. If he comes right now, they're ready. They're preparing. They're like that bride getting ready. She's always got her perfume on hand. She's got her dress ready to slip into. When she hears the sound, the bridegroom is coming, she's ready. The parable of the virgins, the 10 virgins, 5 who had oil in their lamps, they were ready when the sound came, the bridegroom is coming. And 5 didn't have oil in their lamps, and they weren't ready. And when they went to go get oil, by the time they came back, they were left out. Where are you? Are you ready? You know, I think the state of readiness is an important picture. Now, in the state of readiness, you see, Jesus is saying, look, when you see these things about to take place, the leaves are starting to shoot forth. You have indication that time is short. Watch, lest you be sleeping. Peter says that the coming of the Lord will be like a thief in the night to the unbeliever. Paul says, God didn't appoint us to wrath, however, in 1 Thessalonians 5, but to obtain salvation. We're not children of the night. You know, his coming that Mark speaks about is a coming of judgment, of desolation, because of the abomination. You know, there's only so much the Lord tolerates with people, yet how patient is he to endure the mockery, the self-proclaimed godhood of many people, which will eventually culminate in the ultimate deception with the Antichrist proclaiming himself to be God, and then that'll be it. But in the meantime, we should have a sense for the rapture to be imminent, because there are no signs that have to happen for the rapture. The signs are for the second coming. But it only makes sense. If the signs for the second coming are starting to show, then the rapture is even closer. Now, whether we have a year, or 5 years, or 10 years, or 20 years, only the Lord knows. Will these birth pangs take another lull? Maybe this decade that was so horrific, maybe it will be better in the next decade. Maybe the birth pang will settle down a little bit and before it gets worse again. Nobody knows. But I want to be like that servant waiting and watching and ready. I want to be anticipating his coming. I don't want to fall asleep and think, well, you know, it's not going to be for a while. Because if you think the guests aren't coming over, you're not going to bother preparing anymore. And all of a sudden they show up at the door. I thought you weren't coming. Oh, you didn't get our message? No, he's feeling fine. We're here. I thought you heard our message. Oh, I'm sorry, you're not ready for us? We'll come back another time. No, come in. And you got underwear all over the place. You've got stuff, the kitchen's all a mess. You know, you're in your nightgown. Not going to work, is it? I wonder how many Christians, seriously, are going to be caught by surprise. You know, there are those who make a big deal out of how, to what degree, but I think a true believer, those who are anticipating the coming of the Lord, you see, they're going to live in such a way that it purifies them. In fact, one of the most amazing passages John writes to in 1 John chapter 3, he says, "Beloved, we're children of God. It has not yet been revealed what we shall be." We don't know what we're going to be, but we know when he's revealed, we'll be like him, for we'll see him as he is. And then he says in verse 3, and everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. I think having that hope abide in you, that man, look, when things are going really good, you tend to think, I want to just continue in this life for a while and see my grandkids and my great-grandkids and enjoy life. Things are going bad, you're like, Lord, would you come please now? But you know what? In both cases, we should look, when the things are bad, we should look for opportunities to let Him be known, to shine our light, to let people know circumstances don't get us down because we don't live, this world is not our home. We got something better to look forward to. And when things are going good, we should use every opportunity to remind ourselves, hey, don't hold on too tightly to this. Let it flow through your fingers to bless others, that opportunities for the gospel. Whole point is that purifies us. That hope is a powerful hope. Jesus said, behold, I'm coming quickly. When Revelation was written, he says, behold, I'll show you those things which shortly must come to pass. He wasn't referring, because someone would say shortly, it's been 2,000 years. No, he goes back to that. When you see these things take place, everything is going to go very quickly once you see these things beginning. Just like that. Those final labor pains. When you start getting 5 minutes apart, ladies, you know, if you're not in the car on the way to the hospital, you might just be delivering that kid in the car. You better get there, because once those things get that close, everything happens rapidly. In fact, just when you start labor, you know, okay, once labor starts, it happens rapidly. So I really believe that we should have this picture for ourselves. Watch and be ready.